everyone. Before we start, I wanted to let you know, if you would like to watch our whole service, head to our website. That's dc2.me. And from the media drop-down, click sermons. You can watch our whole service there. And now, here's this week's sermon.
Good morning, Discovery. Before we get too far into the day, I'm just going to invite you to take a big, deep breath. We're here. We're here together, and it's good to be here together. As we jump into our morning, today's teaching is grounded in the book of John, chapter 21, starting in verse 15. It says this: When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" And he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." A second time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." And he said to him a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter felt hurt because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep." And after this, he said to him, "Follow me." Well, my name is Zach, and I'm one of the pastors here. We're continuing on in a series that we've been in for the last several weeks called Hero of a Thousand Faces. And the goal of this series is really looking at some of the final words that Jesus gave to his students and really gave to anyone who wants to follow him, where he says, "I want you to go and make disciples," which is a kind of Christianese word. I mean, really what he's saying there is go and mentor. Go and be a part of a community where there's these layered relationships. It looks kind of actually like a family. We've got older people pouring into younger people, people who are along the way. We're all on a journey together, and I want you to be relational in what you do with me. It's not just about passing on information. This is not about behavior modification. This is about relationship and mentoring and transformation that way. He invited everybody to pursue each other. So he's asking us to find mentors, he's asking us to mentor, and all of this begins not with a blind date kind of a setup. I mean, it's not just a belligerent, like, I gotta go find somebody today. The invitation here is this comes through community. This is why we do things here at Discovery like patio parties. This is why the lobby is so important. That's not just a place for us where you walk through as quickly as you can, either on your way in or on your way out. It's why we built a coffee shop. We want a place to go and stop for a second and sit down and enjoy a conversation with somebody. And this next week will be a big week. Next Sunday, you probably saw these a few weeks ago if you were here, but as Jake mentioned in the video, we've got so many things that are coming up that are getting kicked off. So if you're coming to Discovery just thinking, I just really am looking for community and connection, here's all the stuff that's going on in the world of community and connection. And next Sunday, we'll just be asking everyone who calls Discovery home, what are you doing? Do you want to jump in on one of these? And if next week you're like, well, I kind of feel like I have that, or that's not maybe what I'm looking for the most, I'm really looking for more like, I want to be mentored, I want to grow. This orange card, you can find these out in the lobby. These are all the things that next week we'll just be asking you, where do you want to jump in? And if you call Discovery Home, we just ask, would you consider one of the things that's on this list? Now, as we go through today, I want you to consider what God is inviting you towards. And as you do that, this theme of the hero's journey has just been so helpful for us as we've been going through this series on discipleship, on mentoring. This is the whole idea. This is how a relationship works in the world of mentoring. It starts with an ordinary person, somebody like me or somebody like you, that answers a call. And in this setting, that call is, go make disciples. Go mentor. Direct from the mouth of Jesus himself. Oftentimes that looks like teaming with other people. You begin learning new things. Last week we talked about you cannot avoid the struggle. And Jesus already knows where those struggles are going to be. And today we're really focusing on these top two. And we'll have one more week that will follow as we kind of figure out how do we loop back down here. But what about this idea of experiencing revelation? And what does this idea of life change look like? As we get into the day, we cannot talk about these stages as too divorced from any of the other ones. They naturally build on each other. You do not get to experiencing revelation without first taking the path all the way through struggle. Last week, we talked about this idea of struggle and what happens when we experience pain or weakness or disbelief or a bad choice, whether our own, whether in somebody who's leading us or somebody that we're leading. These steps today depend on that stage. If we're going to experience revelation and change, it will almost always come out of places of struggle. And there's all kinds of struggle. There's struggle when my car breaks down. There's struggle when I burn dinner. And those struggles count, but we're talking about some struggles maybe of a deeper matter. Have you ever walked with a friend when it comes to infertility? When the word cancer is muttered by a doctor? When trauma from childhood is acting like a block that just refuses to let them be their true self? When faith is what's needed, but it just seems to be the one account that's bankrupt? And what about not just when you're walking with a friend who's experiencing things, but what about when you're experiencing these things? Who walks with you in the struggle? When these things hit, getting an oil change or watching another YouTube video, they're only going to solve so many problems. So what happens when we hit a struggle that we can't perform our way out of or learn our way out of? What happens when life happens? And one thing I love about Jesus is that he's just unafraid to meet us in our places of pain and struggle. I think it's actually one of his favorite places to work in. And I think that's why it's so embedded not only in how he designs discipleship and mentoring as a journey, but it's a necessary ingredient in today's good story. Some of you may know the name Ann Sophia Mutter. Ann Sophia is a world-renowned violinist, and she actually had some absolutely fascinating dialogue with some students at the university about suffering. She was speaking to a group of students in Germany, and she was asked the question, "What part of the world is producing the best violinists right now?" And this is her response. She said, "Well, more and more it's the East Europeans and Asians who are coming into the foreground. Russians, Japanese, the Chinese, the Koreans." The student asks, "How can you explain this?" And Anne says, "They have a greater capacity for suffering." The student says, "That sounds like solitary confinement with an instrument. Isn't there a nicer word you can use?" And Anne, I imagine in this room, a crowded room of some of the best violinists in Germany, pauses for a second and then looks this person dead in the eye and says, "No. That comes with it. And it's not meant to be negative. It has to do with passion, demanding something of oneself." It's curious to me that in order to be a great musician, suffering is necessary. And note that the way Anne is talking about it, she's not merely saying suffering through practice, beating your hands or your voice or your instrument into submission. She's talking about geography. She's talking about demography. She's talking about anthropology. She's talking about your life, your story. It's not the suffering of music, it's the suffering of the person, your person, that will make you a great violinist. And this is not only true of musicians, but of composers as well. If I may, I'd like to invite us into this idea of suffering and elegance through one of the best pieces of music ever composed. Johann Sebastian Bach was a sought-after teacher and a composer in his own time. The year was 1720, and he was asked to teach music in the royal home of the German prince of Anhalt-Cothen. It meant a walk that was a couple hundred miles away from home, and when he left, everybody was totally happy and healthy. He'd just written the fourth part of a four-part, what's called a partita. It's a beautiful piece of music you can still find played all over the world today. And when he left, his wife Maria particularly kissed him and hugged him, and he left. The work in the royal house went to plan. As you can imagine, during that time, not only was the telephone not quite yet around, but the post office was also a pretty slow process. So can you imagine the shock of Bach returning home to discover not only that your wife had unexpectedly passed away, but that she had been buried a week prior? In his grief, Bach pulled out a completed four-part partita, and he set to work adding a fifth part to a newly completed work. This part that ended up being longer than all the other four parts combined would go down in history as one of, if not the most incredible pieces of music ever written. This is what it looks like, just a piece of it, on sheet music. Johann Brahms, one of his later contemporaries, said, "On a single staff, for a single instrument, man writes a whole world of the deepest thoughts and the most powerful feelings. If I were to imagine how I might have made or even conceived the piece, I know for certain that the overwhelming excitement and awe would have driven me mad." The best violinist of our time, arguably Joshua Bell, once said this about Bach's Chaconne: "It's not just one of the greatest pieces of music ever written, but one of the greatest achievements of any man in history. It's a spiritually powerful piece, emotionally powerful, structurally perfect." So I was researching this week, there was a forum where there was clearly a young violinist who had just had asked a group of other violinists, if it's a good idea to start with, if I'm learning Bach, should I just start with the Chaconne, just jump into the deep end? One of their responses was, "Only if you want your face to melt off like that scene in Indiana Jones." Would you like to hear a bit of it? Here's the first 2 minutes, and I'd love for you to consider not just that you listen with your ears. The violinist who's playing is a Ukrainian, Russian, German violinist named Mark Bushkov. Watch him. What do you feel as you hear this piece of music? I know oftentimes in Broomfield and North Denver, we are not the most artistic or musical culture, so I'm asking of you some big stuff. Open up the best of who you are to receive a piece of music this morning. Here's just the first 2 minutes of the fifth part of the partita called the Chaconne. The way I hear the story told is that Bach came home and almost immediately starts writing this. It's incredible. I mean, the way he sounds like he's literally either trying to break the violin with the bow or break the bow with the violin. The entire piece takes over 15 minutes, and to hear it in its entirety, while I'd love to play it for you, I knew that some of you would be enraptured and some of you would be wishing that the rapture would come. But if you're into it, I can't suggest enough sitting in a place later today where you can really engage this, to sit with Bach in a place of deep struggle and deep suffering and listen to how he engages with it. Not just absent-mindedly listening, but listening with your whole soul listening, and see if you can tap into what Brahms and Bell are talking about as they listen to it. And yes, the whole piece remains at that level of intensity, but there's so many elements that he begins introducing and adding in. As you continue, the piece just takes some incredible turns. When you listen to Bach, It's so clear that his plan is not just to remarry and slap on a happy face and pretend like hard things don't happen. Over the course of his life, Bach had 13 children. I think only 5 of them survived to their teenage years. He's a man acquainted with grief. And the prolific nature of his music happens not because he's getting out of the grief, but because he's remaining within these dark places, because in the dark, he meets something there. As we will see, transformation, revelation, life change, it doesn't happen by escaping struggle, but by finding that God's presence and love are waiting for us and desiring to meet us inside of the struggle. And we can learn to play beautiful music in dark places, and we become deeper people. As we pick up our teaching today, we meet some characters who are far from slapping on happy faces and pretending like nothing bad has happened. The scene we read earlier between Peter and Jesus is just incredible. Some have called it the best conversation in all of Scripture. But the context matters. So for those who weren't here last week, we talked about some scenes that happened just days before this particular encounter. The night before Jesus was killed, he talked about some things that were going to happen. And as he was doing so, he grabbed a bowl of water and a wash rag, and he washed the feet of his disciples. He took time to share with them that he was going to die, that he was going to be back. And Peter, one of his students, one of his mentees, not wanting to be separated from his teacher, interrupted him. And this is what he says. John 13, starting in verse 36. Jesus has just said, I'm going to die, and you can't follow me. And Peter said to him, Lord, where are you going? And Jesus answered, where I'm going, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow afterwards. And Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. And Jesus answered, will you lay down your life for me? Very truly I tell you, before the cock crows, you will have denied me 3 times. 3 times. Why 3 times? It's likely to make sure that it wasn't a fluke. I mean, you say something once, it might have just been happenstance, it just rolled off the tongue. But you say something 3 times, you mean it. It's an odd shot for Jesus to call, but Jesus is calling his shot here. In moments, Jesus will be taken by a mob, and Peter will deny him once, twice, 3 times. And then to his horror, is on Peter's path of being a mentee, a disciple. He will wander square into the face of struggle as he watches his rabbi and his friend be crucified on a Roman cross and then be buried. As the story goes, 3 days go by. Jesus is raised to life. This is where the story gets really interesting in the book of John. At the beginning of John chapter 20, Jesus' students, the ones that remain, are locked inside a room, and Jesus just appears to them. And the first words out of his mouth, hi, peace to you. It's hilarious. It's a lovely scene. Cannot imagine in this moment what Peter's thinking, how many times he's replayed the thought of, if Jesus showed up here, what would he say to me? All the shame, all the guilt, all the frustration, and the first words out of Jesus' mouth are peace to you. Relief, man. And if you're Peter, what would you do at this point? It seems like there's convincing evidence right in front of you. Not only is Jesus alive, but he's being kind to you. I would be busting out my class notes, getting back to work, trying to remember, what was I supposed to be doing again? But that's not Peter's response. He has a pretty human response. A whole week goes by between that encounter and another encounter now at the end of John 20. And we see his disciples, his students, not out preaching, not out sharing the good news, not out telling everybody, hey, Jesus is alive. Where are they? They're locked in the same dang room, terrified. They have no idea what to do. And this time, Jesus shows up again. This time it seems like it's for the sake of Thomas, who missed out on the last encounter. Thomas gets to put his hands inside of the holes in Jesus' wrists and in his side. It's mind-blowing stuff. Everyone is watching this happen. And if you're Peter, what would you do at this point? It seems like a good opportunity to review your notes and get to work and go out and tell people about it, but not quite. What's he doing? Why does he keep locking himself in this room? What's going through this guy's head? Well, he's struggling. He's suffering. He's trying to figure out how to reconcile what's happening outside of him with what's going on inside of him. It's a collision that any follower of Jesus becomes familiar with after not very much time. And that brings us to chapter 21. And in many ways, it brings us back to the beginning of the story of Peter and Jesus. Where are his disciples at the beginning of chapter 21? They're in a boat. They're fishing. The sons of Jonah, Simon Peter and his brother Andrew, the sons of Zebedee, John and his brother James, they're right back where Jesus first found them at the very beginning of the story. It's like that scene from the moment in Box Life. It's not just back to where we were and everything's fine. It's I'm home. And I've met with utter disorientation. For Peter, I think there was a strong sense of, I flunked out of school. And sure, Jesus loves me, but what do I do now? What am I good for? Walking along the beach, as the story goes, Jesus calls out to these guys. And Peter, in a vintage Peter moment, noticing that as Jesus, from way out on the water, does something highly predictable. This sounds just like something Peter would do. He sees him, he hears his voice, and not wanting anything to get in the way of him and his rabbi, he jumps into the water and just starts swimming. As the rest of his friends are like gently rowing the boat, and they're like, you kind of get in the context, they're going about the same speed. Like they get there right about the same time. And by the time they get there, Jesus has cooked breakfast. And it becomes clear from the context, we find out in verse 20 that they've been walking. Peter and Jesus go for a walk. We get that context because it says John was following them, like this creepy little eavesdropper kid is walking behind recording this story. But Peter and Jesus go for a walk on the beach. And here's the conversation that they're having as they walk. John chapter 21, starting in verse 15. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, feed my lambs. A second time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And Jesus said, tend my sheep. And he said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter felt hurt. Because he said to him a third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. And then in verse 19, after this, he said to him, follow me. This first question is just kind of funny that Jesus asked him, do you love me more than these? What's he talking about? There's a lot of speculation. We don't like totally get it, what Jesus is referring to here, but I think there's good speculation that with everything that's just happened, we've got these boats, we've got his whole fishing business, we got a whole pile of fish in a net. And as Jesus is surveying the scene and just what's there, could it be that he's saying, do you love me more than these fish? And do you love me more than these friends, these business partners, your brother? Do you love me more than this life, this business, this way of living that you've carved out for yourself? Do you love me more than these? I have to believe with a bit of uncertainty. I mean, he's pretty passionate before Peter, but he realized at this point, like his follow-through game is a little weak. As he's being asked, you love me more than these, I can just hear the voice of Peter quaking out the answer, yes, yes, I do. It's authentic and it's vulnerable and it's true. And it's also a question that exposes something. It exposes the part of this relationship, the part of the love that has wavered. Do you love me? That's a question that seems to say, I haven't stopped loving you. I've never stopped calling you my friend. I've never stopped wanting to be with you. But you've changed. So just a quick DTR moment here. Do you love me? Because if you're in, I never moved. It's a question that's not trying to get Peter to realize that Peter loves Jesus, but rather a question that exposes a deeper truth, that Jesus loves Peter.
And that hasn't changed one bit. Peter has changed, but Jesus has not. And for those of us who have been following Jesus for a while, this is a good conversation to eavesdrop in on. John knows what he's doing. All the times we've walked away and betrayed and chosen death or experienced pain or struggle or suffering, here we find a Jesus who says, "You have wavered, but I haven't. Are you in? Because I am right here with you." Jesus' response is bonkers, too. He adds this little note, "Feed my lambs." Let's camp out there for a second. "Dude," he seems to be looking to Peter, "dude, I'm changing your vocation. I know it's senior year, we're changing your major. You've been majoring in fishing, now I want you to major in being a shepherd. I'm calling you to do something other than what you've chosen for yourself. So my question is, do you love me more than these? Is a question of, do you trust me?" And he doesn't just say, "Go feed lambs." That's a big deal. He says, "Feed my lambs." Jesus is not simply inviting him to general work, to a general call. This is my family business, according to Jesus. I, Jesus, want you to come work with me. I want to work with you shoulder to shoulder. You being called to this has little to do with you being good at this. And Jesus is telling Peter here, "I still want you. I'm still calling you. Your struggle does not disqualify you. I'm asking you to do it with me, to be with me as I do it. I'll be with you as you do it." And again, here's one of the biggest places where I think many Christians become functional atheists. I have so many conversations where I hear people say, "Yeah, I hear that Jesus is inviting me to mentor others, but I'm just not sure what I'd do or what I'd say." Our fear is that we're being asked to do general work, that we have a general call, that we are being sent out on our own. We're invited to join the team, to work alongside Jesus. These are his sheep. He's in charge. He's involved. I'm not alone. Do you have faith that this could be true? And if so, what more do you need to get started? And then he does something odd. Three times they have the same conversation. "Do you love me?" "Yes." "Feed my sheep." John, the author, again, who's like creepily trailing this whole conversation within earshot, changes up the words a bit from sheep to lambs and from tend to feed, but the point is still there. Why three times? Some speculate it's an undoing of the other thing that Peter said three times. "I'm not with him. I'm not with him. I'm not with him." Jesus invites him to take it back. "I am with you. I am with you. I am with you." And it's so lovely that after this, Jesus says, okay. So we're back to square one. Here on the seashore, near your nets, having just reviewed your struggles and your suffering and your faithlessness, now we're back on track. So where do we start? In verse 19, "Follow me." But to say that we're back where we started, it's not entirely true, is it? We're deeper. Maybe when they first met, Peter had a sense that Jesus loved him, but now, after all they'd been through, after his betrayal, Peter knew it way more deeply. The call to follow Jesus before may have seemed like an invitation to an education, to knowledge, even tickets to watch the freak show that was Jesus. But now, "Follow me." It took on a whole new flavor. It wasn't an initiation to go back where they were before, to rewind the tape to that Passover dinner and pretend like the struggle or the suffering never happened. Jesus was meeting him not out of the struggle, but within it. And as if he was saying, "Here, even here, I'm inviting you to know me. Follow me. And most of all, I want you to know my love." And it's in that love. He's not only met with relationship, but also with a mission, a restoring to the thing that he was always called to do and be. Go. Tend to people. Feed people. Care for people. My people. With me. And it's all thanks to the struggle and the suffering and the thing that brought him to that point. was the fact that he experienced the struggle, that he knew Jesus more deeply. These are the struggles of mentoring, of spirituality, the ones that don't have a practical fix, but the ones that need a relational fix. You can't just get out of this. These are the types of things that we all go through that really the solution is, I just need somebody to join me in this, because the answer won't be on the outside of the struggle. I need to understand who I am and who God is from inside the struggle. And so we're back to this idea of the hero's journey. The revelation that we experience, the change in the lives of those that I like with, will likely come from patiently remaining with them in the struggle. Not hurrying them through, not getting impatient, but often reminding them to look for God's love there, in the midst of it, not outside of it. To consider the presence of Jesus within the struggle, not wishing their way to the other side where surely he must be waiting for me to get through. And wait. In his breathtaking book, The Sound of Life's Unspeakable Beauty, author and luthier, violin maker, Martin Schlesky also shares some thoughts about Bach's Chaconne that have a lot to do with this. This is what he writes. Just imagine, in 1720, he undertook a journey with the Prince of Anhalt-Cothen, his employer at the time. His wife was quite healthy when he took his leave, and he returned to find that she was dead and already buried. The Chaconne is an earth-shattering composition in which Bach tried to come to grips with this catastrophe. For me, it is one of the most breathtaking answers to suffering ever given by the human soul. Pain and remembrance roll on here without end. Within the vast complexity of this work, I hear a simple theme. Pain that in the end finds comfort. Hope that cannot be of this world. Questions that cry out and finally come to rest in consolation. The Chaconne is incomprehensible. It begins with the violin's desperate rebellion, its driving questions and despair ringing out time and time again. There are these forlorn monophonic sections, such as measures 84 through 87, that seem unable to escape themselves, only to be embraced again and again and again by a warm, protective polyphony, a voice that does not answer questions but consoles. In composing this piece, Bach must have known a comfort that exceeds human wisdom. Nothing is sugar-coated in the Chaconne, and yet it somehow is able to dry your tears. You can hear heavenly intercession in it as the violin grows beyond itself. As if someone is reaching down into your world, the violin becomes a pipe organ with all of its tone colors and polyphony, a space-filling, all-enveloping chorale emerges. I believe that the Chaconne is grace interceding in the life of a man gripped by sorrow. For hundreds of years, the chorales that J.S. Bach had interwoven into this piece for solo violin had remained hidden. They were only recently uncovered through the harmonic analysis of pieces such as Christ Lay in Death's Bonds, Thy Will Be Done, Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring, In My Beloved God, and finally Thy Will Be Done, Lord God, all pieces that Bach wrote later. We know from Bach's writings that he consistently attributed spiritual meaning to certain harmonic progressions, and so this breathtaking work for solo violin is an encrypted song of praise. Bach did not quote these chorales formally, but called them forth in a veiled way through the sounds of the violin. Oftentimes, I think the word here is always. He meets us in such a way that we know him better always in the struggle. It may not take us out of the struggle, but we come to know him in the midst of the struggle. And simply being with him is enough to choose to remain. Often the revelation is not how to solve the problem, but the revelation is, I have experienced God's love and his presence even here. It's the realization that God loves me in a whole new way or in a whole new place that I didn't understand before. The most real thing becomes not the struggle, but the most real thing is God's presence and love within the struggle. What makes Bach's Chaconne so incredible is that it transcends the loss of death of his wife and it begins to take you somewhere else. It's an invitation to an experience that Bach had, a shout of hope that no matter who you are, there's something more waiting. And likely the more is an experience of God and his love. This idea of lives changed. Naturally, when I come to know God's love in a new way or in a new place of struggle, it just changes who I am and how I act. I can hold still and trust him instead of thrashing and just trying to get it right or trying to get out of it. And when I'm mentoring someone, my goal is not behavior modification or transmission of information, but transformation and experience and relationship. The first 2 minutes of the Shikoan that we listened to were certainly moving. They were absolutely dark. And again, I'd love for you to listen to the entire thing on your own, but would you like to hear some of the pieces that Schlesky talks about, this heavenly encounter that he talks about? Would you like to hear what Bach met within his struggle? You will continue to hear in this part that's almost the last 2 minutes, still deep cries of pain and suffering. But to compare this to what you heard earlier, there's something so much more going on. Check out this couple minutes. There's parts, if you close your eyes, where you'd swear there were like two or even three violins playing at the same time. I mean, it's opened up into this incredible, like, there is pain, but like, what's he doing? There's something beautiful and light that keeps entering into the darkness, and he's experiencing it all, and he's putting into some lines on a sheet of paper so that a violin can just blow it up in front of you. It's so cool. No matter what you've done, or what's been done to you, no matter your struggles and how you've treated them or how they've treated you, how other people have treated you, the invitation of Jesus and the invitation he asks us to offer to each other is to trust that even in the midst of your struggles, we can seek to know him. We don't have to try to escape them. We don't have to help others escape them. We can know him in the midst of them. And even in the darkest places in struggle, any struggle, we can know even there the love of God. And in knowing him, we are absolutely invited to join him on the mission he's always had us on, to know him and make him known. If you're wanting to know more about this, if you're wanting to take steps towards this call to mentor and disciple, whether you're just looking for community, whatever it is that you're longing for in this invitation to know God, just invite you, as we look at next week and beyond, where is he inviting you to go further up and further in on all this? On your way out today, between the double doors or even on the QR codes on the back of your chairs right now, you can find all of that information. Music is such a gift to us because it opens up and unlocks parts of ourselves that we just don't get when we're living just in our heads all the time. So as we wrap up our teaching for the day and then turn it back over to the gift that is music, and invite those of you that are able to stand and to participate in responding in kind.